Welcome into this special edition of the Oncology Peer Review on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Fowler. As part of the Between the Lines video series, Cancer Network spoke with Ludmila Batsanova, a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Diego Health, and Frederico Albrecht, an oncologist and hematologist at the Miami Cancer Institute, which is a part of Baptist Health, South Florida. The two dissected some really interesting research and spoke about when and how to use real-world evidence when making treatment decisions for patients with EGFR-mutated non-small cell lung cancer.
Today's featured article is Benefits and Limitations of Real-World Evidence, Lessons from EGFR Mutation-Positive Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer. I'm Dr. Luda Bajanova, thoracic medical oncologist from University of California, San Diego, and I'm joined by Dr. Frederica Albrecht from Baptist Health, South Florida. So the paper that we're going to be discussing today is by Naja and colleagues, and that is a review paper. And the aim of this review was to provide an overview of different types of real-world observational studies. And they also discussed the benefits and limitations of what we call the real-world evidence as a complement to clinical trial data, and explain how such evidence can be used to help inform treatment decisions using examples from observational studies in patients with EGFR mutation-positive non-small cell lung cancer. So what they did a literature review of real-world studies, searching PubMed and ASCO Congress abstracts, using search term real-world or observational and EGFR and non-small cell lung cancer. And then they collected those articles. And then still out of that article collection, they selected certain papers based on their potential relevance to the topic or narrative review. And then they also, which is important, cross-check the references for duplication of patient population. So the key features of randomized controlled clinical trials and real-world studies. So when we practice, we always first refer to randomized clinical trials or prospective clinical trials, and real-world evidence is recently came to view, and we're starting to use real world evidence a little bit more frequently than before. And I think it's important for us to understand the difference between a randomized clinical trial and real world studies. And in this paper, they come up with several categories. So the key purpose of the randomized clinical trial is to find out if the drug works. So we're asking for efficacy. In real world evidence, we're asking for effectiveness, which is efficacy in a real world setting. Types of the studies, randomized control trials are usually interventional, real world, observational. Randomized are always prospective. Real worlds can be both prospective and retrospective, and there are strengths and weaknesses of both. And then patient population in randomized clinical trials, it's very homogeneous because they all have to meet a certain criteria to get in. And in the real world evidence, the patient population is usually diverse. It's more representative of what actually happens in the real life. Eligibility criteria, again, in randomized clinical trial is very strict. And in real world evidence, you might not even have any eligibility criteria. You just want to follow how your population did in the real practice. In randomized controlled trial, treatments are generally fixed, prescribed by the clinical trial, and in the real-world setting, definitely it's variable. You might have a slightly different dosing, slightly different schedule. Comparator arms in randomized clinical trial, we always, not always, always have some type of comparison. It's either going to be standard of care or placebo-controlled. And then in real-world setting, usually there is no direct comparator arm. In a real-world setting, they can compare how two different patient populations did, but it's not really a true comparator arm. Again, common sense, randomized clinical trials have randomizations, real-world evidence do not. Blinding never happens in real-world evidence, sometimes happens in randomized clinical trial. Follow-up is very strictly specified in randomized clinical trials. We know when the scan needs to be done. We know when the patient needs to have blood work done, when the EKG needs to be done. And in the real world evidence, it basically flows as we go, as per routine clinical practice. In the randomized clinical trials, is usually the physicians who take care of the patients are highly selected. That they are investigators; they have to, you know, pass a certain criteria to be named an investigator. And then in the real world evidence, it's real physicians who take care of the patients, sometimes mid-level providers. And then patients' monitoring is very strict and very prescribed in a randomized clinical trial. We cannot do one step left, one step right. It has to be exactly by the book. And then in the real-world evidence, the follow-up and monitoring is certainly variable and different with different physicians and different practices. And so what are the types of real-world evidence studies that they highlighted in this paper? And I'd like to look at that slide from the right side, because we all started with case studies. And when we were fellows, we always published case studies. So it's kind of the low evidence, real-world evidence data. And then one step above is going to be cohort studies, where you report on a group of patients. And then one above, it's going to be post-marketing studies, which is usually studies that pharmaceutical companies agree to conduct at the request of the regulatory body. And they are usually there to generate some additional kind of real-world evidence where the patients are being treated in a real setting and might not fit the criteria of eligibility that we saw in clinical trials. Then we have patient registries. I think in lung cancer, the most famous registry is a RET registry. Those types of studies are actually very useful to study a low incidence diseases. And it's usually organized systems that certain ask certain questions, and either physicians or even nowadays we see patients derived or patients driven registries. Like, for example, in the EGFR space, we have registry of patients who develop small cell transformation, which is organized by patients itself. And then we have retrospective observational studies, which we analyze historic data to look at specific outcomes. And certainly they are more likely to be biased and confounding factors than the prospective studies. And I think the most strongest real-world evidence data we can see is from prospective observational studies, which are designed to establish primary outcomes, pre-specified outcomes. Patients are not randomized, and treatment is the physician's discretion. But because it's prospective, there is some uniformity in the data that is being collected on that clinical evidence. And so this is, we pulled a couple of examples of what we can see in the real-world evidence data, as well as prospective clinical trials. For example, before osimertinib became a standard of care option for first-line therapy, we were using it in second-line therapy for T790M-positive patients. And on the left, I show you an example of the AURA trial. And then on the right, this is a real-world study of osimertinib, 3,000 patients with EGFR T790M-positive non-small cell lung cancer. This is another example where the real-world evidence can certainly be very helpful. So the same drug, osimertinib, on the left side is paper by Soria looking at osimertinib in a newly diagnosed EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer. It's a prospective randomized trial. And then on the right, you see a real-world evidence that specifically asks the questions, how do octogenarians do if they have an EGFR mutant lung cancer? And as you know, elderly patients are not included in the clinical trials frequently. So having a real-world evidence here is actually very helpful, because it describes to you how the people with advanced age or octogenarians do with the same medications that was tested in a clinical trial. Another example with afatinib. So as you all very well aware, the afatinib approval is based on LUX-Lung-3 and LUX-Lung-6. But as you also aware, that there are some challenges with afatinib, and dose reductions are actually common. And this on the right side of the slide, you can see a real world evidence looking at impact of dose modification of afatinib in the patients with EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer. And the last example I'm going to give you, I think it's also very important. In oncology, we are guided by guidelines, which we have several guidelines to choose from. And sometimes I think it's important to understand how good is our adherence to the guidelines. And you can also have a real world evidence which looks at adherence patterns. And this is an example of adherence patterns to the molecular testing in patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer. So I think I'd like to basically ask Dr. Albrecht is, what is the key take-home message you have from this paper?
Well, thank you, Dr. Bessanova. You know, great presentation. It is very, very important. It's very important to acknowledge that the randomized controlled trial that is the gold standard, we all know that is the gold standard for the for our evidence-based medicine, and this is how we advance science, right? But the problem is that we need to also understand the limitations of those randomized controlled trials. We know that the test in the randomized controlled trials will test efficacy and safety under well-controlled, well-defined clinical condition in selected patients. And that is sometimes a problem because it includes a narrow group of patients that that follows a strict inclusion and exclusion criteria. So when you're talking about inclusion and exclusion criteria, you are excluding patients. So not all the patients will fit for those randomized controlled trials. So it is important to know how those patients that were not included in the in those randomized clinical trials will do with such therapy. This is how the real world evidence come in. So the real world evidence will actually provide complementary data to these randomized clinical trials in real world events, meaning that will include all those patients that, that were not incorporated into the randomized clinical trials. So it's important to know and understand the limitation of the randomized clinical trials, that limitation of generalizability, and also think about all this. You know, the randomized clinical trials sometimes are costly and takes a long time. And when you have a comparator, like a, you know, the standard of care, by the time the trial is presented, that standard of care is no longer relevant because the real world patients are receiving something else. So this is you know, how the real world evidence comes handy, and actually many regulatory agencies, and including ASCO, has recognized this as a very valuable way to obtain data, and obtaining data in the way to help the clinician, the thoracic oncologist, make decisions in the clinic with real patients not incorporated into those randomized clinical trials. So you see, it's important to find out, and you know what, you know, one of the key things that that I believe happened is why we are seeing now more and more, you know, more and more real world data is, I think, in this country is because we have now used electronic medical records. And that electronic medical records and that collection of data electronically give us the opportunity to collect that data either retrospectively or prospectively and collect a lot of data and make sense of those, of that data. And what Dr. Bessanova has shown you in those slides that compare the randomized clinical trial versus large trials, you know, retrospective observational trials that added to those randomized clinical trials. So I think those are the, you know, the key things to understand the differences, you know, between the two and how the two complements the information that a clinician can have in the clinic to treat your thoracic patients. And I think in the second part, we'll talk a little bit more about the GFR specific group of patients, right?
Yes, perfect. Thank you so much for your answer. So kind of to summarize what you just, said, it is certainly they are useful for us. You have to be very careful when you compare randomized clinical trials and real world evidence. I feel very strongly that they are not there to compare each other. They're there to complement each other. And so next thing is going to have a poll. You have a poll on the right side of your slide, on your screen. And the question is, how often do you incorporate real world evidence in your clinical decision making? Go ahead and please answer. So looks like about 11% of us using real world evidence always, 89% saying sometimes, and then 0% for rarely and never. So I guess the next question would be, what are the pros and cons of randomized clinical trials or real world evidence? So advantages is that certainly, as I showed you in an example of octogenarians, this also can give us an information about a population that would not have been included in a clinical trial, and also gives us insight in a real world treatment pattern. The sample size is definitely going to be larger, as you saw with the T790M paper that I showed you. There was a 3,000 patients compared to the same paper in a clinical trial that included around 200, 300 patients. Dr. Alberg already mentioned the economicity of the real-world evidence. It's certainly they're less expensive to run. And then, however, we do have to understand that the real-world evidence studies do have limitation. And Dr. Albrechts have pointed out a couple of them. Their data might not be consistent because, we have a, term garbage in, garbage out, right? So if your electronic medical record is not searchable or not, collecting some of the data, then you will not be able to look at the data. Also, I think very important thing to understand for the studies comparing different treatments, cohort may be unbalanced. For example, in lung cancer, if I would run real world evidence data and compare the outcomes of patients with early stage lung cancer who were treated with surgery and compare real world evidence for patients with non-small cell lung cancer who were treated with radiation for the early stage, I think it would be very clear to envision that patients who were getting radiation will do worse because there is a reason why they were not given the surgery. They were probably had more comorbidities, maybe significant pulmonary issues. So you really have to be careful when you compare to different cohorts. Recall bias is real, and we definitely have to be mindful of, how much information our patients are actually giving us and what's going in the medical record. And then the last one I think it is very important to understand is, especially when you're comparing progression-free survival, which is reported in a clinical trial, and progression-free survival, which was reported in the real-world evidence, because you have to understand how was that progression-free survival done? Because in randomized clinical trials, we usually use RECIST, and there are certain criteria, and we have to call it progression if it's above certain number, and we wouldn't call it progression if it's less than certain percentage. And also the schedule, like if I on a clinical trial am required to do scans every 6 weeks versus in real-world data, if I'm only doing scans every 3 months, then certainly my progression-free survival in real-world evidence would be probably longer because I'm not scanning the patients as much. So I think those would be very important to understand. And so the next polling question we have, for which of the following types of information do you see the most value in real-world evidence? And go ahead and please answer. So your options are effectiveness in real world clinical practice, patient subgroups not routinely included in clinical trials, and then real world safety and management of adverse events. So go ahead and vote. Dr. Albert, can I have your comment on the results of this poll?
Can you tell me the percentage? Because I, for some
You
reason,
can
I
see
can't
it here.
see
So
that.
80% of the people felt that patient subgroups not routinely included in clinical trials are the most likelihood of them using. And number two was effectiveness, and not, and 0% answered real world safety.
Well, great. I think I agree with the group because, as I said, the randomized controlled trials many times exclude different subgroup of patients and that we encounter in the clinics, and we want to know if that specific medication, in this case a TKI, will actually help patients with certain EGFR mutations, for example. And there were actually a sample of a paper that actually showed and randomized controlled trials. The randomized controlled trials, many of those papers included only patients with, for example, exon 20, 19 and exon 21, and excluded many of those uncommon mutations that were uncommon, but when you see many patients with lung cancer, you tend to see. So the answer of whether a TKI was effective in those patients were not answered by the randomized clinical trials. So it was until many of these retrospective observational studies that showed that, for example, afatinib was active and effective in patients with uncommon mutations. And actually, this is an important observational real-world study that, or actually a combination of real-world evidence that actually led one of our regulatory agencies, the FDA, to approve afatinib for the uncommon mutations. So this is a clear example how a regulatory agency can accept and interpret, I mean, accept the data and the evidence of that of those real-world evidence and actually formulate an indication. So this is actually something very important that to know. And the other important thing is about, for example, many physicians want to know, for example, what to do with patients with brain metastases. And brain metastases were actually many times not included in those randomized clinical trials. So they were run, this real-world evidence trial that showed, and there were a couple here in this paper that showed that even though the outcomes of patients that received TKI were inferior for patients with brain metastases, however, there was a TKI, in this case, afatinib, that showed an advantage to first-generation TKIs. So in this way, we can actually know when we present, when we encounter this type of patients, that we can feel reassured. And as I said, answering for this question number two, patient subgroups that were not routinely included in those clinical trials, we can be assured that with this type of information, we know that we can certainly treat those patients in our clinic. So, this is an example where by this real-world evidence, you can actually have a TKI and know that that patient may benefit from. So those are things that I believe those are the benefits of real-world studies. Obviously, there are some limitations that Dr. Bacenova, I think, attached that you can be aware, but definitely is a complementary data information, right? So I think that's my take on this polling question.
And I can actually cannot agree with you more. I think the one, in addition to the couple of groups that you mentioned, the one that actually strikes deep in my heart is patients with leptomeningeal carcinomatosis. And especially if we're talking about EGFR population, because those patients have a high risk of developing leptomeningeal disease, especially the longer they survive being on EGFR TKIs, And unfortunately, those patients are routinely excluded from the clinical trial and trials. And all the evidence we have for those patients, there is actually only one clinical trial, it's called Bloom, that looked at osimertinib in leptomeningeal disease. But the rest of the data we have is actually from real world evidence, prospective and retrospective and case series. And I think it is very important for us because we have to treat the patients and we have to give some idea to the patient of how effective the treatment is. And at this point, the only information we can give our patients is from real world evidence. So I definitely agree with you that it is absolutely complementary. This is again to summarize what Dr. Albrecht just said. So we feel that in addition to you know, the categories that we've discussed, I think other ones that are important to include in real world evidence are elderly, and we didn't talk about it, but the poor performance status. There is a paper cited in that review article where EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors were given to patients with performance status of 3. I think it's a very real patient population, and we do come across them on a regular basis. And you know, sequencing therapy is also important. And in clinical trials, unfortunately, as you see from, let's say, osimertinib study, the FLORA study, we really do not have a good collection of data after the patient progressed on the current therapy. They come off the study, and not a lot of studies collect subsequent therapy, which would be important when you look at the evidence of the overall survival. And I think also, though, where the real-world evidence can also give us some information is how do patients do when we sequence therapy one way or another? And so I think this is a very interesting question is, what if you have a situation where clinical trial data and real world evidence do not agree? Do you follow the clinical trial data or do you follow the real world evidence or neither? So if you can go ahead and vote. Okay, I'll wait for here. First, the poll has ended. So it's interesting answer. So 63% of us said that they, in the case where they have disparate results, they will follow the clinical trial data. 25 for the quarter will say follow the real world evidence, and 12% will say neither, which, you know, probably opens to some additional clarification of that answer. But Dr. Albrecht, what do you do?
Well, I would say number four is both. you know, this is how sometimes our practice is not science. I mean, it's not straightforward. It's more like an art, right? We have sometimes partial information, not complete information, and we have to actually make it a clinical decision based on what we have. We know that randomized clinical trials are the gold standard. And this is how we advance science, and this is how we interpret data. And we have to follow those because it's what, you know, how science is advanced. So, but we understanding the limitations, many times those randomized clinical trials will not incorporate the patients or the group of patients that you're taking care of. And obtaining real world evidence data, I think, might actually give you an answer. And sometimes could be contradictory, and you're going to have to employ your common sense and your knowledge to review if that data was well collected. Remember, those are the limitations of the real world evidence. Well collected, if they were associated with bias and some other, you know, form of bias, as Dr. Pesenova commented. So based on that, on the search you do and the experience you have, you're gonna put everything together and you'll make a decision. I think both give you good information, complementary information, actually the real world evidence, and that will give you, I think, even in the future, more and more information in those patients that were not incorporated in randomized clinical trials. I think those real world observational prospective studies are here to stay. They can, if they are done really well, well conducted, they will produce powerful information, and that information will be used by the regulatory agencies to either modify or change or approve medication. So it's very important. And again, I say, I reiterate this, is because we now have electronic medical records. Our electronic medical records are still, you know, have a good way to go, because we can do a much better work, I think, eventually. But when we actually manage that data, I think we're going to be able to advance medicine, as you know, and oncology and thoracic oncology much faster. And is and why? Because remember that we used the gold standard, the randomized clinical trials, but those, that trial tends to be sometimes slow and costly, and by the time, how many times you have the results of a huge randomized clinical trial that tells you that this medication, TKI, is better than chemotherapy, and then, for example, you don't do that chemotherapy anymore, the standard care has changed for real world patients, so you are left kind of in you know, not in limbo, but not with a complete answer. So I think when the results are not completely concordant, think about, you know, the group of patients that that were seen in the real world evidence, how that data was collected, and you will for sure have follow up real world evidence studies that will either corroborate that or refute that. So I think that is my intake in this new era, let's say, of data collection.
I think we do have a couple of really good questions, which I want to make sure that we cover. And I do want to be mindful of the time that we have allotted to discussion. So I guess I'll summarize the discussion. So I think the potential implication of this paper is to raise our awareness of real world evidence and describe different types of real world evidence, describes pros and cons of real world evidence. And I'll answer the second question, will you do anything differently in your practice now? At this point, I don't think so in my practice, because I am a believer of real world evidence and I do use it mostly though when I need to decide what to do with a population that was not included in the clinical trial that we've discussed today. And I would like to, there are two questions which I really like, and I'll answer the question and I'll ask Dr. Albrecht to answer as well. So the first question is, in your opinion, what are the best sources of real world evidence? I mostly see registry studies, but I feel like electronic health records would be better. Dr. Albrecht, what do you think?
Again, I was commenting that our electronic medical records are at the beginning, I believe, technically. Still a little, many times, you know, we don't know where exactly put the information, but as long as we do a real good collection of information from those electronic medical records, I think that is probably the best source we're going to have, because we can see what happened with real patients with you know, with many characteristics, and we can group these patients prospectively and reach conclusions and interpretations from this data. So I think electronic medical records will be the future, will be the way to go.
I actually completely agree with you. I think this is an untapped resource. And it is also clear that we have several vendors for EMR, and there are certain vendors that are actually very penetrant across different institutions. and care everywhere that we can, basically collect the information from different institutions. I don't think we have figured out yet how to get it in a kind of more compliance appropriate environment like the IRBs or whatever, because it still will require the IRB submission. And I think also as electronic medical records continue to evolve, where currently a lot of data we have in EMR is more with text data rather than a searchable and extractable fields. But in the future, I think I envision that it would be much easier to extract the data without manual reading of the note from the physician, but more able to extract the different data fields. And we can, I think, use that information a little bit more frequently. And I think the best sources of the real world evidence outside of the EMR, again, it's very similar to what we do in the clinical trials, right? So single institution retrospective analysis, I will have much less confidence in than, multi-institution retrospective analysis. Registry, as I mentioned, I think is a wonderful thing to do for very rare conditions where single institution, you probably will not be able to find enough patients to, be statistically powered to answer the question. But a registry certainly takes a little bit, effort to set up. It's much, much more difficult than just do a retrospective analysis. And another question, which I also like, what populations, aside from geriatrics, do you see in clinic but are underrepresented in clinical trials who might benefit from real-world evidence studies? And I know, Dr. Albrecht, we covered, several of them, like brain mets, the leptomeningeal meningeal disease, advanced age. Can you think of other categories that we could benefit from real-world evidence?
Well, besides of the, remember I touched on the uncommon mutation, I think is a clear example of how a real world evidence data has led to the approval of afatinib for this indication. The other group of patients is, you never know whether a patient that is with poor performance status. Remember that many randomized clinical trials will exclude any patients with performance status above two, above one, actually. So what happened if you have a both elderly patient with bad performance status? Would that patient have more side effects for a TKI? So I think there is a paper actually included in this paper called the Real GDUD study that showed actually that. What was the safety in those patients with poor performance status? If there is any worse rash or diarrhea or mucositis or paronychia, and what happened with the strategy of managing those side effects and, for example, those reducing, and this is how by a randomized, actually not a randomized, by a real world evidence, there was a proof that those reducing from, let's say, from 40 milligrams to 30 milligrams of afatinib, the effectiveness of the TKI remains there, but the side effects were actually much better controlled. So you have not only corroborate that on these patients there was no new side effect or no worsening side effects from those patients that received a TKI under these controlled clinical trials, or those randomized clinical trials, but you can actually see that those patients, that those real patients, when you dose reduce, you can maintain that effectiveness and at the same time have a control in the side effects. So those are the group of patients that you feel confident with those real world evidence that doing what you do, makes sense. So I think I would probably say uncommon mutations and patients with poor performance status is a group of patients that real world evidence has helped me a lot in making decisions for those specific groups not included in the randomized clinical trials.
Perfect, thank you. I fully agree with you. I think another area that we have that is emerging where I think the real world evidence is gonna make a difference is What should you do for our EGFR mutant patient once they, let's say, develop resistance to osimertinib or resistance to other drug? And I think at this point, since we don't have any, besides MET inhibition, we don't have any prospective data, we are forced to pay attention to case reports. And I think until we get more prospective data, that's where the real world evidence is actually going to help us. Okay, so I think I do want to be mindful of the time, and I would like to, first of all, thank my co-chair, Dr. Albrecht, for participating and providing valuable discussions today. And I would like to say to thank all of you for taking time away from your family and being with us and helping us go through that manuscript. Thank you so much.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. To watch more videos in Cancer Network's Between the Lines series, visit cancernetwork.com/between the lines. The Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast is the official podcast of Cancer Network, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter @CancerNetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn @CancerNetwork.